everyone, and welcome to Straight From the Shoulder, the podcast where we strive to analyze geopolitical events through the apolitical lens of intelligence officers. I'm Julia Stone, Senior Director of the Arkin Group, and for the past 15 years, I've worked in both public and private sector intelligence. I'm here with Spy Master Jack Devine, former Acting Deputy Director of Operations at the CIA, and the founder and president of the Arkin Group. Today, we're going to be discussing what Hollywood gets right and what it gets wrong in its portrayal of the spy world. Jack, I'm really looking forward to chatting with you on this. As you and I were talking about, Hollywood simultaneously serves as a fantastic recruiting mechanism for groups like the CIA, glamorizing the work of intelligence operatives. But it also contributes to some of the biggest misunderstandings of what spies actually do and how they operate. Let's begin with the man who is perhaps the world's most famous spy. And no, I'm actually not talking about you here, Jack. I'm talking about none other than Agent 007.
The first time I saw Sean Connery, I was in a restaurant in London. And he walked in, and I was sitting with C, the head of the British Intelligence Service. We were with our wives. It's important in life to have a humiliating experience. So he walked in and the entire restaurant fluttered. And I looked at our wives and it was like Bobby Sox was all excited. I didn't do it.
I bet.
The head of the British service did it. He said, we don't get it. He was speaking for me without authorization. We're the real thing. They broke out laughing. That thought that was a hideous thought that we were the real thing. There he is across the room, James Bond. So many years later, I shared that story with Sean Connery. He didn't think it was as funny as I do. In retrospect, what you really want to, I think, appreciate is he was a very, from my perspective, very classy actor and played his role very well. Off screen, you know, I found him to be a smart gentleman. Now, I did mention to you once that he was a Scotsman, so we need to bear in mind that his enthusiasm for the Queen and the monarchy may not be quite as keen as it's portrayed in 007 movies.
Well, that's part of the acting, right? Did he have on screen, did he display some of the characteristics that would make him a good spy?
Well, his looks, wit, charm matched all the people I worked with.
Well, did you know anybody at the agency who reminded you of James Bond?
Well, I certainly didn't remind anybody of James Bond, and I'll leave the others to decide for themselves. But I said he was like Cary Grant. He had that just presence and projected so well. And I think it did a great service to CIA in the sense that many young people saw it and thought, that's the real thing. I want to be part of that action. And then they learned that you really have to do things quite differently. And I'm sure we'll get to that eventually.
What are some of the most, I know that you're not, you know, a huge fan of James Bond and his portrayal of what actually happens, but what are the most realistic aspects of James Bond in terms of how he conducted business? I mean, are any of those car chases or, you know, information handoffs, is that real?
You're really pressing me to the wall here because I struggle. You know, those car chases, you're supposed to be a clandestine spy. You're not supposed to be seen racing up and down the Via Veneto. If I could stretch my imagination, I would say at its very best, if you have the composure, courage, and imagination that was portrayed by James Bond, you'd be at the top of the game. And that part's worth emulating, but within the lines.
Well, one thing about him, and I think you mentioned this, and maybe this goes into the least realistic aspects of James Bond, is he always seems to get everything done by himself. This is something that bothers me about a lot of shows about police departments. And, you know, you have this like one lead detective who solves the case. Is that something that you see in the agency, or is that pure cinematics where one person kind of gets the whole job done and all the glory?
Actually, that's a fascinating point, which I haven't dwelled on before. You're actually, I'm going to choose the word carefully, ostracized if you look like a self-promoter, that the attention's all about you. CIA, your career, they don't really and cherish and embrace that, you know, individuality. They want you to be part of a team. And I can't tell you how many operations, the most important ones, involve multiple people who are unsung heroes. But you can't have that in a movie. It's like Charlie Wilson's War. It's too boring to say that, you know, you had 50 logistics people making, you know, driving mules across China. You know, that might make for a good movie scene. But sitting in your office doing papers and editing someone else's cable isn't nearly as exciting.
Well, I'd like to pick up that that theme, Jack, in terms of Charlie Wilson's War. I know that was an operation that you were intimately involved in, particular aspects of it. Is there something about that movie, you know, when you were watching it, that just was just clear to you was inaccurate? And was it purely for cinema purposes it was inaccurate, or is the historic account inaccurate?
Well, Charlie Wilson and I had dinner. It sounds like I have dinner a lot. Charlie Wilson and I had dinner in Sparks Restaurant in New York. And the reason Charlie wanted it, because he's a romanticist. The head of the mafia, Paul Castellano, was assassinated on the steps. So he thought that was just the right kind of place for a spy master and a congressman from Texas, who in many ways, you know, he was a very smart guy. He was a graduate of Annapolis, but he had pizzazz that I have seen in very few people. But during dinner, he reached across and, you know, in that friendly gesture and put his hand on my arm and said, "Jack, I know you didn't like the book. You're going to hate the movie." And then we all started laughing because he knew what I meant. He was one of the great marketers. If you can have a war named after you, and it's a positive war, you don't want the bad wars named after you. I mean, it's a phenomenal marketing. But he knew what I knew. And that is, in many ways, it was organized as a government program with many, many government people doing very specific jobs, and it came together. Now, he was very important in his relationship with Congress and, frankly, with a couple of heads of state. So he had a role for sure, but it wasn't running the war itself. That's not how wars are run. That's not how the Afghan war. So he knew I took umbrage at that. And, well, in good humor, he and I got along quite well, traveled out to Pakistan. And I think I found him a great partner in this, but it wasn't his war.
That's interesting, actually. I haven't thought about it, how in so many spy movies, even if there's a team, often the team aspect of it is sort of minimized or takes second rate to just propping up one superhero, and how in real life that the kind of teamwork and that kind of tedious effort to make a whole isn't very glamorous and isn't very dramatic. But perhaps it should be. I mean, maybe there's an opportunity to glamorize. Have you seen any movies, or can you think of any examples of TV shows that show that process well, of when intelligence operatives and analysts kind of collaborate for a greater outcome?
Well, let me add a footnote to the Charlie Wilson's War. It's not that I hang out with actors. They happen to be in the St. Regis Hotel, which is a story about that in my career training program, operational one. And there was Seymour Hoffman minding his own business, sitting at lunch with a couple of people. And I don't do it. I usually don't walk over, and I'm very careful not to show attention because I think they're just troubled by everyone coming up and making a fuss over it. But I couldn't resist. I went over and said, "Well, Mr. Hoffman, you're a great actor, no question about it. My wife is a big fan. So I just wanted to know the role you played. This had nothing to do with the reality of it." So he looked at me, "Well, here's another crazy New Yorker." And he said, "Well, thank you for your service." And that was very classy. He came back and said, "God, I hope he leaves in a hurry." But I couldn't resist that point. So coming
New York encounters.
Well, coming back to movies, I mean, you go back. In fact, they actually showed it during my training. You won't even remember this movie, The Guns of Navarone. And the reason they showed The Guns of Navarone was we were taking a demolition training, blowing up things. So they blow up this big gun in The Guns of Navarone. But what you saw was a ragtag group of people that were put together as a team and what they could get accomplished as a team. Mm-hmm. And I think, even though that wasn't the intent of showing me the movie, Oh, by the way, I almost flunked that course. You'll have to ask me why someday.
Oh, no, but I'm going to ask you why right now.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
Let that slip.
So when we went, first of all, they take you to a special place when you do demolition training, and you're treated better. People in the military realize when you're working with explosives, they make sure you get really good meals, better accommodations. And there's a reason for this, right? So I know it's going to sound like I'm exaggerating. And even at the moment, I thought, is this a Hollywood actor? The first speaker came out, and he was bald, and he had a V-shaped scar in the middle of his head. And to this day, I swear he was missing two fingers. He starts out, and he says, gentlemen, at this point, it was only gentlemen. Today, it's 50-50, but men and women. But he said, working with explosives is dangerous. No kidding. Okay, we got that point. So when we got around to blowing things up, unlike James Bond, I cut an extra 6 inches on my detonating cord. So I made sure that I got 15 feet away, further away than anyone else in the explosion. So when the items, when they were actually telephone poles were being blown up, it would go 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, and then mine would explode. they just didn't have the sense of humor that I had. So it said in my file, I passed, I got a passing grade. I must have done some of the others a little better. It said, you pass the course, but whatever you do, do not let them near explosives. So the irony was, when I took over the Afghan task force, I was responsible for more explosives than anybody in the history of the agency. Now, the truth of the matter is I wasn't actually running around placing them, but I mean, I was involved with more ordnance than anybody, which is our biggest program. So, yeah, when you look at movies, then real life can be a tad different.
Well, in the movies, it seems like one person sometimes gets a role where they have to be a sort of a superhero. They have to be capable in many different aspects of the spy world, both like the technical aspects, what you're talking about, logistics, detonating things, while also dealing with human sources. So are there examples, maybe James Bond, maybe someone that you like better, of someone who displays on screen really good tradecraft in either recruiting a source or what that process looks like? Or is the process too long in real life to replicate on screen? What's your take on that?
You're hitting a receptive chord here. I'm finally drawing into a point that I would like to make that I think is critical and a part of the movies that I like. There's a difference between a spy and a spy master. The spy is the foreigner who works in the Kremlin or works in the Cuban Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The spy master are people like me that run those assets, right? So in the movies, you tend to actually see more what you would expect from an agent and not a spy master. The movies that intrigue me are more of the psychological drama of spy masters and how they look at operations and the chess game that's played. And you would say, well, gee, that sounds like a contemplative headquarters position, but it's done in the field as well. It's how you look at an agent and how you run operations to protect them from harm's way, how you collect that information, how do you watch your counterintelligence shoulder. Now, there are really good movies that go into this, but they're usually tied to the mole part of a movie, where there's a penetration inside the firm. So there's the action person, James Bond, and we certainly haven't, I should say this too, there's a whole world of special forces inside the sea, paramilitary people, that are in the front lines of battles around the world, and they're doing things like James Bond without the glamour. They're certainly not in tuxedos and drinking martinis. But, if you look at Iraq or Afghanistan, there are CIA personnel in harm's way doing dangerous things. So, but they're not, you would not categorize them as spies. They're action people.
So the movies pack all of these different roles that would normally be, belonging to 10, 20 teams of people, and they put it into one person. Is that what you're saying?
But I've come to terms with that. I mean, I recognize that Hollywood, for example, how do you get terror? And I mean, the movies are, Alfred Hitchcock, there are people that specialize in shadows and this and the other. How do you get emotions in the movies? Argo, right? Argo is the one where CIA people are able to get out of Iran after the takeover of the embassy and how that was managed. I doubt there was, I seriously doubt, I know there weren't cars, jeeps running down the airplane field about to shoot the plane. No, but they were scared to death when they walked by that exit point where they had to show their password. So you have to have this auxiliary drama because you're not capable to show someone's stomach turning over and the cold sweat and fear that's there. So I think movies, you have to cut them some slack on this. And so I don't, as long as they show the right thing, which is this was a very risky, dangerous, fear-fraught moment. And so, you know, they do put things together, but I'm much more flexible today than I was when I was first looking at movies and first beginning when I was beginning my career.
You're certain it's evolving because there are positive aspects of portraying spies in this way, which we'll talk about. But there was one movie, Jack, and I think you and I have different opinions on it. It was called The Lives of Others. And what the aspect of the movie, which was in East Germany during the Soviet era, it involves sort of a government effort to listen in and to this sort of domestic surveillance and how the individual working for the government becomes empathetic and relates to his subjects in a very sort of human way that we don't often see portrayed in films. It's, you know, not exactly going native or becoming really close with your subject or switching teams, but is that common in the agency?
You're talking about the spy who came in from the cold, right?
No, but we could talk about that as well. Just talking about
what happened. I mean, that's the fundamental line in the story. Where this hard seasoned operator, spymaster, right, identifies with this agent, and then the agent is basically, I'm going to ruin the movie for people, but has a bad ending, right? But it's that whole point about empathizing with your asset. And I can't tell, this is true in the armed forces as well, when you have foreign teams working for you, is the emotional attachment. Leaving Vietnam, leaving Afghanistan was brutally painful for the people that worked in intelligence business with people you left behind. So there's an emotional part to it. It was interesting that CIA, as a matter of policy, abroad, moves people about every 3 years. The Russians actually stay in 6-7 years in some places. And they want them to get more identified and they blend in more. And they get, the longer you're in a place, the better you are. I mean, the more capability and skill you have. But I think we often thought we have to avoid what you call in the business clientitis. In other words, you suddenly feel like the country's right and America's wrong on some issue. And you begin to lose your balance in it, or that this asset somehow, you know, is undervalued, or, and you lose your focus. And the key thing in CIA, in the intelligence business, is you need to have clear focus on objectivity, whether it's the reporting or the situation you're in. You can't afford, and it's very hard, we're human beings and have the same passions and desires as everyone else, but you have to discipline it. And then one way to ease it is, you know, before you get too identified with a country, move you on to the next posting. And you could, I could argue both sides of that, but I think it's probably on balance a useful thing to do.
That does sound like a tough balance, because you want to have someone that knows what they're doing, but you don't want them to have blinders or have emotion overtake their view on the real reality on the ground. But I appreciate it when movies kind of portray that more human aspect of working with other humans, because that becomes your team too, right? When you're a spy master, your assets, they are part of your team.
I can tell you one case where it was what I was around the edges of, and that was the Falklands War, or Malvinas for those in Latin America. And that is, there were many of our people that so identified with the Latin American interest in it, that they lost their objective and did not realize that Great Britain was going to come and was going to go to war against them, that somehow they didn't think that that was going to happen, that America would sign with Argentina. And it's like you missed all of history of the United States and World War I and II. I mean, these are all very smart people. But because they were so close to their subject matter, they missed what was really going to happen. And I think there was a lot of disappointment as a result of that. So objectivity is something that, you know, you have to strive at, and it's hard.
That's something that you often, Jack, connect with human sources and having the ability to talk to a lot of people on the ground and not relying solely on technology or on SIGINT and signals intelligence and other things like that. How does Hollywood, what's Hollywood's portrayal of sort of spy tech? I mean, is that realistic? Does Hollywood copy things it sees, or what's the dynamic?
You're going to get annoyed with me, so I'm going to divide it into two parts, sorry. So the first part is I do think human intelligence is coming back. And I think when we look at some of the things that happened in Israel with Hamas, it's not that AI and technology is not really useful, but it has limitations, and you have to realize that. And the only antidote for those limitations is to have human sources and primary sources. And I've been pounding that drum for a long time. My sense of the private sector, I noticed that the private sector is getting much more interested in it, and our government seems to be back because I think the Israelis will be back into it. So the second part is technology. And, you know, I like the Jason Bourne movies, particularly when you can see one and two, because number one, it's great action, right? It's, again, we can tear it apart, criticize the action. But the technology is great, although I was sitting there saying, well, we have the pieces, but they're not integrated. When you get to Jason Bourne 2, you find out that by then you actually have it. So Hollywood, you know, when you go back to Maxwell Smart, you'll have to go look up the book.
Yes, the Maxwell shoe phone, of course.
Okay, but, you know, you'll have to look at James Bond. But over the years, if you start to look at what looked, you know, the phone, that, you know, talking to the phone, I mean, the miniaturization, I would give Hollywood high marks. This is the one area particularly of somewhat visionary and how you would apply. Now, I knew somebody that was head of technology in our agency in the technical support area, not satellites, but spy gear. When Casey was the director of CIA, he'd see something on TV and call down and, why don't I have a watch like that?
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant.
And because we're very responsive, so I want to go out and try and figure out how to turn the Timex into a telephone.
Excellent. So it's a two-way street when it comes to technology. Hollywood and this three-way, the spy world influences them, and then Hollywood influences operations. So ultimately, and I guess we'll just wrap it up here because there's so much to discuss with different movies, but has Hollywood helped the image overall of spies, or has it hurt them?
I think it has been a great asset to this, to the people in the spy business, as I said, for recruiting and for, it's fascinating how much respect CIA personnel get, that people get in the foreign environment. The issue I have is that we have had presidential leaders who have agreed to undertake covert action programs that they were basing it on the assumption that CIA can get it done if they say they can get it done, or if someone asks them to get it done. And that is a mistake and a flaw that's generated inadvertently. It's not a deliberate thing by Hollywood. And that is not really looking down at the realities and questioning those capabilities. As I said, the Bay of Pigs is a classic example where Jack Kennedy was personally knew Ian Fleming. I mean, knew him, and that was his favorite reading material. And he just overestimated. First of all, Eisenhower gave him the folder, and he thought, a four-star general, commander of World War II, this has to be a reasonable program. And then the CIA people, you know, were ready to go. So he, and he was relatively new at it. I was new in a policy place surrounded by great advisors. And I think this is the type of thing. So to me, it sticks in my head as a classic example where the glamorization, which is so useful to people like me, is not very useful at the policy level. You have to be much more critically focused on capabilities.
I hope that next week we can discuss a topic that often comes up in the movies when they're covering spies or clandestine operations, and that is betrayal, the issue of betrayal. So I hope that you all can join us as we dive into that topic using some of Jack's firsthand experiences and maybe referencing some movies along the way.
This episode of Straight from the Shoulder has been produced by Jen Scorey-Vogt.